The status of whales in the Gulf of Maine. Several large whale species frequent the offshore waters of Maine. There's the huge finback, the humpback, the minke, and the endangered North Atlantic right whale. This has not been a good year for them. Whale deaths and strandings appear to be on the rise for three species. In the past year, 29 minke whales have been found stranded between Maine and South Carolina. In the past 2 years, 62 humpback whales have been found dead or distressed on the East Coast, and the right whale population, despite great efforts to reduce entanglements, appears to be declining as well. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll learn more about the whales in the Gulf of Maine and threats to their population. We'll also hear from biologist Nan Hauser, whose video of a humpback whale appearing to save her from a shark went viral. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. If you are lucky, you have caught sight of a whale breaching or spouting just off the coast of Maine. We have several kinds of whales here, but recent reports of high numbers of deaths raise concerns about whether these massive marine mammals are in trouble. Today, we're going to find out what's threatening the whale populations and what people can do to help. Joining me in the studio, Aaron Summers, who is director of the Division of Biological Monitoring for the Maine Department of Marine Resources. And Dominique Walk is the Assistant Stranding Coordinator for Marine Mammals of Maine. As always, want to hear from you. Have you ever gone whale watching? Do you have questions about what to do if you see a stranded whale? Do you have experience working with whales? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both for being here. And maybe, Aaron, I'll start with the basics. Sure. My understanding, there's four kinds of whales, the minke, the humpback. Go ahead, take
sure,
over.
Sure, yeah. Well, the smallest one that's more coastally, that you see more coastally is a minke whale. And then we also have humpback whales, fin whales, and the most endangered is the North Atlantic right whale.
How many are there? I mean, I know that there are more whales in Maine in the summertime, especially in down east Maine. At its peak, how many whales might be off our shores?
I guess it depends on the time of year, as you just said, or the species. We just finished reviewing stock assessments for all of those species of whales. The North Atlantic right whale is the most endangered, and in the entire population, we've got about 450-ish whales. And there's been new studies that have come out recently that have shown that right whales have been in decline since 2010 due to declining birth rates, high mortality due to human interactions such as ship strikes and entanglement in fishing gear, and some of their health indices are declining as well.
So of that 450, how many are going to pass through the Gulf of Maine?
We have sort of a migratory population of right whales in Maine, so we don't have the dense aggregations like you get in some other feeding habitats. So, for instance, in Cape Cod Bay, in basically starting at now through like April, you get feeding aggregations of right whales up to like 200 to 300 animals,
wow,
which is a large percentage of the population. There was historically a feeding aggregation in the Bay of Fundy, so we would get those sort of transient migratory whales coming through Maine waters as they head that direction. Recently, they haven't been using that feeding habitat as much, but they've been heading up more towards the Gulf of St. Lawrence in Canada. Potentially, they're looking for prey because it's not available or aggregating in the same way as it used to in the Gulf of Maine.
And I'll ask you about why in just a
sure.
second, but I want to bring you into the conversation, Dominique. I understand that this has been a really frustrating couple of years for people who care about whales. Kind of summarize for us what's happened.
Well, this is a pretty interesting time for whales in Maine and throughout the Northeast region. Right now, we have three concurrent unusual mortality events that are going on in the waters from Maine to North Carolina. And that includes for the species of humpback whales, right whales, and minke whales. And an unusual mortality event essentially means that there is an unprecedented and unexpected above average number of whales that are dying. And there needs to be a direct action to figure out why.
So that's what I was going to say. We don't know why, right?
Yeah, there are no confirmed analyses that cover why that whole right whales specifically or humpbacks, but we're doing necropsies on as many animals as possible. A lot of those necropsy results are still pending, but we are seeing a lot of human-derived issues such as blunt force trauma consistent with ship strikes or entanglement in fishing gear. And then for the minke whales, we're also seeing some infectious disease as some of the causes of death. So
the infectious diseases that the whales are getting, is that have to do with a change in their habitat?
Right now, we don't know what those infectious diseases are. So the next step would be to figure out why they, where they're coming from, how they are getting them, and why it's causing them to die. So it certainly could be from changes in their habitat. It could be from prey abundance and aggregations like Aaron mentioned. So that's the next step, is to figure out why.
Mm. And Aaron, I want to go back to that and talking about prey. I know different species of whales eat different things, but what are we seeing with their food supply?
Yeah, so right whales feed primarily on something called Callinus copepods. So they're small planktonic critters that aggregate in dense layers in the water column. Some of their, as I mentioned before, their feeding distribution is sort of shifting right now, and we're kind of trying to play catch up to see where they're changing their movements to. It seems like they're moving more into a search pattern where they're searching for those dense aggregations of prey that we used to get year after year. So whether that be changes in water temperature or circulation patterns, changing when those copepods aggregate or if they do into the dense layers. Right whales are a really large mammal, so they need really dense aggregations of those copepods.
They need a lot of food.
Yeah, exactly. So if they're not finding those dense aggregations, then they're in a kind of a search pattern. So they're part of the problem is they're exploring different habitats that we're not used to seeing them in. And there may or may not be protection measures in place there to protect them while they're there, because we're not used to having them there.
Right. And what about the other whales and what they're eating? Is there plenty of food, or is water temperature changes affecting that as well?
I think that's a little less understood as far as distribution changes in the other species. Humpback whales, for example, are more fish eaters. So and I don't think that has shifted as drastically in the Gulf of Maine, but that is something that needs to be explored for sure.
Some of these whales that have been discovered in distress, they are a lot thinner than they ought to be, correct?
Yes, yep. And Marine Mammals of Maine's job is to respond to the animals that are stranding on Maine's beaches, both live and deceased. And so especially for the animals that we have seen in necropsied, they are in poor nutritional condition, whether it's from poor feeding capabilities from being entangled, not being able to feed because of injuries sustained from ship strikes. So a lot of these animals are showing some signs of poor nutritional value, which may or may not be because of food source or because of what is causing them to be injured in the first place.
So we need to figure out, if someone sees a whale they think are in trouble, should they call you?
Absolutely, yes. There is an entire network of stranding responders throughout the entire East Coast. Marine Mammals of Maine responds to Kittery to Rockland, Maine, and we have a 1-800 reporting number, and any marine mammal or sea turtle can be reported to our hotline. And if it's floating offshore, for a whale especially, that is really important information for us to know so we can go check it out.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. How do you know a whale's in trouble? Obviously, if it's on the beach, it's in trouble. But if you're a boater and you see a whale doing something you haven't seen before, what is a sign that a whale's resting, and what's a sign that a whale might be in trouble?
Well, it can be really difficult to distinguish. So the best thing to do is to always just give us a call, and providing information about exact location, any kind of photographs or video that can be supplied is really helpful. But otherwise, abnormal behaviors might be increased respiratory rates at the surface, just more of the signs that would be visible to the more trained eye. So that's why it's important to really just, no matter what, just give us a call.
And if a whale's in trouble but has not died, are you able to save it ever?
Resources are a lot more limited with cetaceans or whales just because of their size. So we certainly do everything that we can to help, but it depends on the size of the animal and what exactly is going on with it. But we have had successful cases of helping some whales in Maine in the past.
And we also, through the state of Maine Department of Marine Resources, have a disentanglement network for large whales. So we participate in a larger Atlantic large whale disentanglement network, and we respond across the state to entanglement reports, and we'll disentangle any of those species with our partners in other states and at the federal level as well.
Erin, you know, over the years, we've heard a lot about the North Atlantic right whale. And for a couple decades there, there was a lot of good news, wasn't there?
There was. They were increasing at a rate about 2 to 2.5% from about 2001 through 2010. So it wasn't until recently that we saw the decline, basically, I think, starting about 2010. Just a decrease in calving rates, the number of mothers that could be eligible to calf but aren't calving is getting higher. And the usually right whales calf between 3 to 5 years in between calves. And right now it's extended to more like up to 10 years in between calves, which is abnormal.
Again, no idea why?
I mean, there are theories, nutritional stress, as we talked about. If they're not, if either because they're not finding the feeding aggregations that they need to sustain a pregnancy, or sometimes if they're running into entanglements or ship strikes and they're compromised that way, then again, they're not going to be, their body's not going to be in a fit place to sustain that either.
All right. Well, we're going to shift gears just a little bit from Maine to the South Pacific. Nan Hauser is president and director of the Center for Cetacean Research and Conservation. She is from Brunswick, but she's currently based out of the Cook Island Whale and Wildlife Center. Perhaps you saw that viral video of Nan with a humpback whale that appears to protect her from a shark. Well, I got to talk to her last week about that and started her interview by asking her to describe the experience.
I have to admit, after 28 years of being underwater with whales, that this was by far the most unusual thing I've ever been through in my life. I was making a film. We make lots of films. And the director said, we need more footage of you with whales. So I said, all right, well, there are a couple of whales here. And I slid over the side of the boat because I have a permit. And normally, you know, they just kind of go past if you're lucky. But this one swam right up to me. And then he didn't stop. And he put me on his head and then his chin. And he rolled me around. And then he slid me down his back. And he put me right by his eye. And he opened his eye really wide. And he was like trying to tell me something. And I can read whales pretty well, but this whale, I didn't know what he was saying. And I thought he was probably going to just whack me with his pectoral fin or his peduncle or his tail, and I was going to be dead. So I had quite a bit of fear, but I didn't panic because I knew if I panicked, he'd panic. And this went on for 10.5 minutes, nonstop. He even lifted me up out of the water on his pec fin. And I felt so... Well, I felt guilty, first of all, because I've been, you know, I write the rules and regulations and policy. And number one is don't get near the whale. Don't touch the whale. And people even say, can I ride a whale? And I'm going, are you kidding me? If you ride a whale, you're going to go to jail. Suddenly I'm riding on the back of a whale and I can't get away.
Were you afraid at all?
Yeah, of course. Of course. I was very afraid. He's huge. He's 1,000 times bigger than me. But I couldn't panic. I always said I was going to die with a whale. So I thought this was the day.
It wasn't until the entire experience was almost over that you realized there were sharks nearby, right?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I was watching the whale every minute because he would not leave me alone. He would not get off me. He would not let me stop touching his body. I mean, I should say he wouldn't stop touching my body. And, you know, my kids and my grandchildren in Maine, that's what I kept thinking about. I really don't want to die and not see them anymore. I kept thinking about Maine and how important my offspring were and what a bummer it would be if I really did die that day.
Nan, what is your experience with this giant whale? Teach us about people's misconceptions about whales.
It's known that humpbacks have altruistic behavior, and they are willing to risk their lives in order to save another species. And we see this in seals and Dall's porpoises and minke whales and young humpbacks. And I've even seen other smaller sharks be protected by humpbacks. They rush into the house like the house is on fire. So I guess what makes it so special is that I'm the first human on record to have a whale protect me from potential danger, because this this shark is still here. And this shark is the biggest shark that any of us have ever seen. I saw it and I thought, oh, I thought it was a Ziphius cavirostris, a large beaked whale. But then it started swimming right towards me really fast, and its tail was going side to side instead of up and down. And I went, oh, and that's where you see me at the surface of the water yell, oh my God, there's a huge tiger shark right here. And the whale pushed me to the boat. He pushed me to the boat and he protected me. He sort of got around the back of the boat just to make sure I got on okay. It was so weird. It was just the most incredible feeling.
It seems as though you still kind of can't believe it.
I still kind of can't believe it. But for me, the whole message is, why can't we be like that? Why can't we be altruistic? Why can't we protect each other? Why can't we show the love that these animals show? I mean, even after they were taken close to extinction, they still have this altruistic behavior. God, if humans could just learn from this. And, you know, the other thing, and this is, I'm not original on this. This is Carl Sagan. He's the one who said, we're spending millions or billions of dollars in space trying to find extraterrestrial intelligence. And here it is in our backyard, and we're killing them inadvertently.
Nan, we've been hearing a lot about whale die-offs recently, and not just one species. How concerned are you?
I'm really concerned, Jennifer, and I really believe we need to join forces. I'm not the kind of scientist that says, hey, this is my data, and wait till I publish it, or I'm not going to tell you. I'm like, here's my data. Come on, everybody. Where's your data? Let's pool it together, and let's get going, because these guys are in trouble, and we need to be their voice, because they don't have a voice.
What advice do you have for regular people who just love these beautiful creatures?
Oh, there's so much you can do. First of all, you can go down to your beach and pick up plastics, because we find a lot of plastics in their stomach. And it does help to write congresspeople or people in politics. But it also helps by using less plastic, by recycling everything, by buying products that don't have a lot of plastic on them, by not pouring bleach down your drain, by thinking about everything that you put into the earth. Where do you dump your oil after you change your oil? Because everything we do ends up in the ground, and then in a stream and a river, and then out in the ocean.
That was Nan Hauser speaking with me from the Cook Island Whale and Wildlife Center in the South Pacific. She's the director of the center, but she hails from Brunswick, Maine. We are going to take a quick break, but when we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org. And Coffee by Design, locally owned and operated since 1994 and dedicated to coffee sustainability. CoffeeByDesign.com.
On the next Fresh Air...
When you think you're going to die, you really start to feel like you're fading to gray and everyone else is still in color.
Kate Bowler was diagnosed with incurable cancer in her 30s. She's married, has a young child, and teaches at Duke Divinity School. Her new memoir is about how her religion has affected how she deals with illness and how illness has affected her faith. Join us.
Join us this evening at 7 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio. Are you a fan of Maine Public Radio and television and understand why listener and viewer support is so important to make it all possible? No, this isn't about Super Thursday. How would you like to lend your hand in being part of the team that makes sure Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Television are successful during those important on-air fundraising campaigns? If so, Maine Public would like to talk with you. We're looking for an organized, creative, detail-oriented multitasker to become our full-time producer of on-air and online fundraising campaigns, part of our development team in Bangor. We've got a complete job description at mainepublic.org. Just click on About and then Careers.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, as you just heard, whales in Maine. With me in the studio, Dominique Walk, who's the Assistant Stranding Coordinator for Marine Mammals of Maine, and Aaron Summers, Director of the Division of Biological Monitoring for Maine's Department of Marine Resources. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Joining me now on the line is Patrice McCarron. She is Executive Director of the Maine Lobstermen's Association. Patrice, thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here, Jennifer.
You know, I know that over the years, lobstermen and other fishermen have worked to reduce whale entanglements. What kind of changes have been made over the years?
We've done lots of things over the years. The Maine lobster industry's been involved in the management process for whales since about 1995. In the early days, we did sort of simple things. We make sure that our rope is not floating at the surface, so if whales are feeding, that risk is not there. We have placed weak links below the buoys, so if a whale entangles a buoy line, the theory is that the rope would slide through the whale's mouth and the buoy would pop off and the whale would be able to break free. More recently, we have changed a lot about how we fish our gear. So a lot of lobstermen will string multiple traps together on the bottom. And historically, we've had rope that floats between traps, and that was also an entanglement risk. So we've taken the majority of that rope out of the water and replaced it with rope that sinks. That rope is actually significantly more dangerous to fish with. It's more expensive, and it actually wears out pretty quickly, so it has to be changed more often. And then the most recent round of regulations that we've done are to reduce the number of buoy lines in the water. So lobstermen who typically might have had two or three traps on an end line have had to up the amount of traps per end line, so the net reduction is that there are less buoy lines in the water. And they're also putting marks on their buoy lines so that if that gear does end up on a whale, there's a way to tell the origin of where the gear was set. So over the years, we have done quite a bit of work.
The recent bad news about the right whale population decreasing must be really frustrating for you and other lobstermen who have done so much.
Yeah, it's really, really sad. I mean, I have to say we all sort of just sit back with our jaws on the table as we've seen, you know, one whale after another die over the last year. The total's up to 18 right whales since, I think, April of 2017. The majority of those whales have died actually up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. It's been a combination of snow crab gear, which is a very, very heavy gear, a very large pot, typically fished one trap per buoy. And the fishery has not been regulated to be safer for whales because whales had typically not been there. And the same with the boating industry with ship strikes. They've had a lot of ships hit these whales, and the whales have died of blunt trauma. And again, they've had no protections in place because historically they haven't had that interaction where those two things are happening at the same time.
And Aaron, this is related to what you were talking about, that the whales are going outside of their traditional routes to look for prey, we think. So
yeah, exactly. Yep, they're showing up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence in larger numbers, and they've had to put emergency regulations over the summer and fall to reduce the speed of ships through that area and try to regulate the fishing industry because, like she said, it has been unchecked to date because the whales weren't there before.
Patrice, before we let you go, what do you think needs to happen next?
Well, first and foremost, Canada needs a whale plan on the books similar to what we have in the U.S. It's very difficult for our fishermen to contemplate how we can help solve this problem when we really only have half a plan on the books. So I know that Canada is working very diligently right now to look at their fisheries, to look at those potential interactions, but they've yet to get sort of a full-fledged plan in place. So, you know, once that's in place, we'll continue our talks with our fishermen to really try to understand what role is Maine fishing gear and Maine lobster gear actually playing in the problem and work on potential solutions. But it's very, very difficult to determine that because they know, unfortunately, precious little about how whales are getting entangled in gear, and they don't get a lot of gear back from whales. So it's kind of like a needle in a haystack other than that snow crab gear to figure out really what gear is causing the problem for whales.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Patrice McCarron, Executive Director of the Maine Lobstermen's Association. We'll go to Andrea calling from Jonesboro. Hi, Andrea. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I've been speaking with Moira Brown in Campobello. She's heads up the Campobello Whale Rescue Team. And Moira was able to get the Canadian shipping lanes changed in 2003 and is trying to get that done again now because as has been mentioned, the whales are no longer really staying in the Fundy region. They're going to the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And so she was able to get the speed reduced of the shipping of the ships last year. She was she got it from 20 miles an hour down to 10 miles an hour. And in addition to that, they're working on rope-free lobster traps. I don't know if that's a possibility here. I hear it's very expensive. And I also want to address the fact that the Gulf of Maine has recently been reported as being the fastest warming body of water in the world. And the whales are the canaries in the mine. And we really, as the woman Patrice said, really have to join together to save the species because, as noted, 18 right whales died this year. And I believe I'm correct in saying that whales provide the nutrition for phytoplankton, which creates most of the world's oxygen and are the base that the fish stocks depend on. So without the fish stocks, the fishermen are going to be up a tree.
Right. Andrea, thanks so much for your call. And we've talked about that a little bit, the warming waters. Do you see it that way, Dominique, that this is, we're looking at the whole ecosystem here?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of different scientists working on this issue from a lot of different angles, and there's still a lot that we don't know. But certainly with whales being at the top of some of these food systems, they are also considered a bioindicator species. So any of the issues that we see in the ocean, regardless of if it's at the bottom of trophic levels or the food chains, we really see those issues exemplified and magnified in these whales. And so that's a lot of what we're seeing now.
How difficult is it, Aaron, to work across international boundaries? The whales obviously don't know any international boundaries.
Yeah, that's something that is sort of coming online more recently. There has been less of that in the past. So right now there's currently a bilateral working group between the U.S. and Canada that was sort of spurred after the 17 deaths that occurred in 2017. But that's at sort of at the federal level, and they're working on bringing some of their regulations in line with what the U.S. is doing.
Okay. Well, Andrea, thank you so much for your call. We're going to go to Zanata, who has a Facebook post here. Considering the current acceleration in the opioid crisis and the possibility and probability of people flushing their meds and drugs down the toilet from being caught with the goods, these drugs and residues eventually go out to sea where the whales live. Are we in turn doping up our whales and other marine life? Are the whales more sensitive to what's being dumped into the oceans, hence greatly contributing to their life survival issues in addition to global warming effects? I followed the issue of, and just an aside here, I know that there's documentation of fish in rivers, especially in the western U.S., being affected by certain kinds of prescription medications getting into rivers and streams. Has that been happening in the ocean that's been documented?
I know some work has been looking at hormones and how they might be affecting fish and sea turtles as well. I don't know if we have any of that information for whales. I think a recurring theme is with whales and marine mammals in general is that we really don't know a lot about them, and they're very hard to study. So there are a lot of things that are probably going on in their environment and having these serious impacts on them that we just don't know about yet.
All right. We'll go to Andy, who's calling from Freeport. Hi, Andy. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes. Hi, Jennifer. I'm a longtime whale watcher. I was hooked back in the 1980s. I've gone out on boats from Portland, the Odyssey Whale Watching Ship. And there's such majestic creatures. I recommend that to anybody who loves them. I think we saw over 40 whales my first time. I saw a double breaching event of humpback whales on that event, which is really rare, I guess. And every time I go with my kids now, we try to go every couple years, we see something unusual. One time we saw a sei whale, which is apparently very similar to a right whale. And I was wondering how rare they are, how that species is doing. And also there was a beluga sighting in along the Maine coast about, I don't know, 5 to 10 years ago. And I wondered how those two species are doing.
Aaron?
Well, the sei whale is actually pretty similar to the fin whale. It's a bit of a more offshore species, and there's a group, I think you'll have Chantal on later. He might be able to speak to that pretty well. They have a photo ID. Do they catalog sei whales? Do you remember?
I think they can, yeah. The same, similar.
But
yeah.
So they're big, like up
they're
to
big.
80 feet. Yeah.
Yeah, they're like the third largest whale, I guess. Blue whales, fin whales, and then sei whales. They, as far as we know, have less overlap with human interaction cases. And then what was the other one? Oh, beluga. Beluga is talking about Poco, I think, was the name of the animal that sort of wandered down from Canada. That was a bit of an unusual sighting for us, and we haven't had another one since then. But, yeah, they tend to stay up in more Canadian waters.
Right, right. Andy, thanks for your call. But, you know, Andy mentioned how much he likes to go out on whale watching trips. And I know it's a really big part of the tourism economy in certain parts of Maine, especially down East Maine, where the whales aggregate in the late summer. And I'm wondering, is that okay? Is it okay to have boats out getting close to whales?
Yeah, I think absolutely, especially for some of the other countries in the world who are transitioning from whaling to more of a tourism industry for appreciating these animals. I worked on a whale watch boat for a long time down east, and I can say from experience that really just getting out and seeing these animals is just breathtaking, an amazing experience that, like this last person mentioned, you do have to be careful with, you know, there are some threats that are posed when you get into the whale watching industry and having boats around them. Maine is really great. There aren't too many boats, but on the West Coast, you see a lot of the underwater noise from these boats can be overwhelming. There's too many boats in one area. It can really affect how whales interact with each other, their ability to find food. So there are some threats, but you know, if done appropriately, it can be a really great experience.
And that's related to, we've got an email from Karen. She writes, the Kennebunk Sierra Club film for January was The Sonic Sea, which investigates the problems whales and other animals have dealing with our ocean noise pollution. Many whale strandings are linked to this activity.
Yeah, that happens in some of the more acoustically active, like deep sea diving species, like beaked whales are really sensitive to ocean noise, but the ocean's getting louder and louder all the time. So that is a concern. There's a phenomenon called masking where a lot of whales, like specifically right whales, communicate in the same bandwidth as, say, a large tanker ship. And so a lot of that shipping noise will make it so that they can't find each other. They have to start changing either their frequency or how loud they call to be able to hear each other and find each other for breeding or aggregating.
When you say the ocean's getting louder all the time, is there significantly more, is this shipping traffic? Is this cruise ships? What are we seeing?
It's a bit of everything. There's a lot of shipping traffic, boat noise, like undersea surveys people are doing. The Navy does a lot of seismic surveys, like any oil exploration, any of that can contribute to it.
All right. Well, I think we're going to go back to Andrea. Andrea, you wanted to follow up on your question from before. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Yes, I wanted to address Erin with her marine resources at the state of Maine level and the federal government. Will they be able to change shipping lanes and slow down those ships from 20 to 10 miles an hour this year?
I can't speak for Canada, but there's a precedent for that in the past, and I think that people have been able to demonstrate a really marked difference when that comes into place. So ship strikes, the number of ship strikes that have happened with right and other whales has dramatically decreased since we've started instituting ship speed limits and also changing the shipping lanes. So I don't think that will be a large hurdle to get over. That is something they're certainly addressing in the Gulf of St. Lawrence for the next year before the whales show up again in the spring or summer.
All right. Well, Andrea, thanks for calling back. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us an email at talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we take a quick break, a word about tomorrow's program. To mark World Radio Day, we're going to talk about the past, present, and future of radio. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet tweet us or post to our Facebook page. You are listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org. And Colby College, featuring the Portland Ballet, performing Yuri Yanowski's Origins, February 9th through 19th in Portland and Waterville. Details at colby.edu.
March 2016, then-candidate Donald Trump names George Papadopoulos to his foreign policy team.
He's an oil and energy consultant. Excellent guy.
But by July the next year, Papadopoulos is arrested and cooperating with federal investigators. I'm Ari Shapiro, how George Papadopoulos fits into the Russia investigation, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio. Coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, we'll have Commonwealth Club of California. Today's speaker is Dean Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean of the School of Law at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of Free Speech on Campus. Chemerinsky argues that campuses must provide supportive learning environments for an increasingly diverse student body, but can never restrict the expression of ideas. That's Erwin Chemerinsky on Commonwealth Club of California at 2 o'clock, right here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program Protecting Whale Populations in Maine. Joining me today, Aaron Summers with the Maine Department of Marine Resources and Dominique Walk with Marine Mammals of Maine. Join our conversation 1-800-399-3566. By hearing that, can you guys tell what kind of whale that is?
Yeah, that sounded like a humpback whale, and those tend to be the males that sing.
Okay, that's so cool. And, you know, before we go to the calls, I wanted to ask you a couple things. I know that we heard from Nan Hauser earlier in the program, and one of the things she had said when I asked her if people wanted to help out, she said her organization takes volunteers. And if you want to volunteer for her organization, either here in Maine or in the Cook Islands, wouldn't that be nice this time of year? You can contact her. We're putting that link on our Maine Calling Facebook page and on our webpage. Do you take volunteers, Dominique?
Yeah, absolutely. We rely on our volunteers and interns to carry out the enormous broad-scale amount of work that we tackle every year. So our volunteers help us with responding to animals on Maine's beaches. They help with beach cleanups that we set up. So there's a lot of different opportunities out there.
All right. We'll go to Robert, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. Jennifer, I don't want to identify people because I want to protect people's privacy, but I'm from southern New England originally, and I'm very good friends with a whale watch captain who, prior to being a whale watch guy, was a fisherman. And he admitted to me, he's one of the nicest people I know, he admitted to me that the fishermen as a community have always been very dishonest about protecting the fishery. Of course, they want to do it, but they put short-term needs ahead of protecting fish populations. And just to follow up quickly on that, I met a guy who was part of a team rehabbing lighthouses in southern Maine. I was walking and talked with him. He had worked on Vinyl Haven the prior summer, and he told me that it was common knowledge that there was a whale that was trapped in crabbing gear or lobster gear, one or the other. And he found out about it, and he was actually threatened if he told anybody about it. And I was very discouraged to hear that. So I think the fishing community has to step up and put long-term needs of water, fisheries, wildlife in a much higher priority than they do now instead of the short-term financial needs.
You're nodding, Dominique.
Yeah, in our experience with Marine Mammals of Maine, the majority of the lobster fishermen that we have worked with have been some of the greatest that we have experienced, always willing to take us out to animals that are offshore that we can't access otherwise. I think that they are always willing to help us out with individual cases as needed, reporting animals to us. We, as the reporting operators, wouldn't. People can always anonymously report locations of animals If people feel sensitive about that as well. But we've had some really great interactions with fishermen to date, and I think their actions that they've taken for the protection of whales has been pretty significant so far.
Yeah, they've been involved with a lot of work through the state, the Department of Marine Resources as well. We tend to try to use them as platforms for scientific research as well. So I've been on lobster boats with guys characterizing habitat for right whales, try to involve them as much in the process so that they're aware of the issues and can be part of the solution. We've had really good experiences, but of course, in any large group of people, you're going to have some that are better than others, obviously. And as far as the conservation mindedness of fishermen, the lobster industry in Maine has been very proactive in the conservation measures that they've done for the fishing industry. So they have done V-notching and vent sizes and, you know, a lot of conservation measures they've put in place on their own in their industry has sort of protected the long-term outcome for lobsters. Specifically, there was a paper that just came out through the Gulf of Maine Research Institute that showed that some of the high peaks in lobster landings as compared to southern New England, which has had a crash, is because a large part because of the conservation measures that they've put in place, and the industry has been the ones that pushed that forward, not the state regulations. So,
Robert, thanks for calling in. We're going to go up to Brooklyn and Michael. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm in the Merchant Marine. We do the mandatory speed reduction for the whale migratory seasons. And I was curious why we only do it for the right whale. And when we see other whales, and we're only supposed to report the right whales if we see one. But why don't we AIS track the whales so it's easier for us to stay out of their way rather than the other way around?
It would be great to be able to track all the whales, and that has been brought up a lot of times for right whales because there's so few of them. There's just not a great way to tag them so that we can track their movements all the times. One of the hallmarks of a right whale is that they don't have a dorsal fin. And so a lot of the time, that's how tags are attached to marine mammals and other species is through the dorsal fin. Because right whales don't have that, previous tags have been implanted in the blubber or the fat on their back, and that has resulted in some health issues for the whales that were tagged, so people have not been doing that. There has been some tagging projects where they've used suction cup tags, but those tags don't tend to stay on longer than a day, so it's a little bit complicated to try to do that and expensive.
All right, Michael, thanks. And I think a lot of people would like to have
that
happen.
Yeah, it would be so nice.
Life
wouldn't
a lot
it?
Easier.
Yeah. We'll go to David in Portland. Hi, David. Go ahead. David, go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I wanted to just share an experience with a whale watch that I went on years ago. I was very, very impressed with the precautions that the operators took. We went out and we saw a humpback. It was being observed by another boat, and our captain informed us that we would stay about a mile or so off until that boat was done with their observation before we went in. The whale actually had other things in mind and came over, and as it approached, the operator turned off the engines and said we would not get within more than a few hundred yards of it. The whale came right up, swam next to us, swam under the boat. I now know what krill breath smells like. And it's just a very educational and fascinating opportunity. And I know everyone on the boat was much more excited about whales after that experience.
Wow. You have a both smiling.
Yeah, that sounds like an amazing experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
David, thanks for calling in. We'll go to James calling from Vinyl Haven. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you, Jennifer? I always enjoy your show.
Thank you.
This was just my first whale sighting ever, and it was kind of unusual. I had a new little sailboat about 20 feet. I was out with my wife and my daughter. This is about 26 years ago. And we were out near Saddleback Light in the eastern Penobscot Bay off Vinyl Haven. Ran out of wind, so we're motoring along, and my wife looks and says, "I think that's a whale." And I look and I see the dorsal fin coming towards us, and I think the whale obviously knows we're here. It will turn, and it did turn, but not in the direction I was thinking. It swam directly under our boat, and it was just a thrilling experience. And subsequently, I named the boat minke because it, I identified it as a minke whale. But I've only seen them out there. You know, I sail every summer. I probably had about 4 sightings usually closer to Idaho.
Yeah, that's so exciting when you you see one. And they're friendly. I mean, this is not unusual for people in boats to have the experience where a whale comes to them. Do you think it's curiosity? What do you think's going on?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, and you'll see behaviors where they start spy hopping and lifting their head out of the water, and you can really see them just eyeballing you, and it's a pretty awesome experience.
James, thanks for calling in. An email from Lori. Casteen Elementary School students work with Mr. McQueenie to actively conserve our right whale conservation. How can student groups like this, the Calvineers, spread their influence within school systems and the general population? Erin, you nodded. You know,
I did. I've seen the Calvineers all over the place. They are a very active group. Students that are involved in the Calvineers come every year to the Right Whale Consortium annual meeting, which is a meeting of basically any researchers that do right whale work. We get together once a year in New Bedford at the Whaling Museum and share our work and talk about how right whales are doing. They put out a report card on the species every year, and the Calvineers are always there presenting what they're doing and listening to what everybody's up to in the research world.
Do we know why they're called the Calvineers?
The Calvineers, they're named after a whale named Calvin.
Ah.
And I don't remember the entire story, but...
Okay,
yeah.
Great. We have an email from Andy. How would offshore mining and oil exploration in the Gulf of Maine, as recently proposed by the Trump administration, affect the whale population and, for that matter, any of the large marine mammals? Do we know?
We don't know a lot, but I think, as we touched on before, the acoustic soundscape would be impacted by any kind of exploration activities or drilling, absolutely. And then, I guess, after that, just the possibility of a spill contaminating the water would be the second thing I could think of.
An email from Pam. I've been on several cruises, and though lovely, the ships are gigantic. And I wonder about their impact on the oceans as they expand dramatically now into Maine.
Those large ships tend to be restricted by the speed restrictions in places of large whale aggregations. So I think for the most part, it's ships over 65 feet that have to adhere to speed restrictions. So they would be in that category. So they're adhering to those.
And some of the there are some pretty large whale watching vessels out there as well, but I know a lot of them have invested in jet propulsion in order to specifically protect the underwater acoustic environment that these whales are inhabiting.
All right, so we'll go to Russell, who's calling from Hancock. Hi, Russell, go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to mention another very serious threat to right whales that is occurring, and that is the Navy. And the Navy is currently constructing a 500-square-mile sonar range, and in which 470 annual sonar exercises will be held. We've up to 3 vessels and 2 aircraft. And that range, out of all the places that the Navy could have chosen on the East Coast for this range, they chose a location just offshore of the only known calving grounds of the right whale.
Is this something you all have followed as well?
As a state, we commented on some of the early plans for that, and I think there was a range in the Northeast that they were proposing. The Navy can be exempt from a lot of the regulations that are put in place for other users of the water, so sometimes that can be hard to get around. But we have... we have commented and made suggestions for ways to make it a little bit less impactful, but I think it is an issue.
Russell, thanks for your call. We'll go to Mateo calling from Presque Isle. Hi, Mateo. Go ahead.
Hey there. I just wanted to point out an awesome, amazing fact that the right whale has the largest testicles of any mammal on the planet, up to a ton per testicle. So just a fun fact.
Thanks for your call, Mateo. You know, I want to go back to something that Nan Hauser said during my interview with her. I asked her what we could all do, and she said, pick up plastic, try not to use plastic. Dominique, when you are finding stranded whales when you're doing necropsies, are you finding plastic in their guts?
We are. Yeah, this is always something that you hear about, and about reducing your plastic waste and bringing your canvas bags when you go grocery shopping. And it's always something in the back of your mind, but you don't really think it's happening in your backyard. But the animals that we have been responding to here in Maine, there was a Atlantic white-sided dolphin that stranded in York on Long Sands Beach, and the necropsy showed there was a green balloon lodged in its stomach and caused a blockage. And that is a very real situation that we see more frequently than we'd like, and it's certainly something that's increasing. We've seen plastic bags caught in the lower GI tracts of seals as well as whales. Any kind of marine debris, if you see it on a beach, it really does make a difference. We've had a handful of animals show up in pieces of monofilament fishing gear, and that can cause some pretty life-threatening injuries.
Is that because of the way they eat, that they're filtering so much water at once that anything that's floating in that water is going to possibly get into their system?
It certainly can be for some of the larger whales. For some of the smaller species that we see, the dolphins and porpoises, it's just something floating in the water that can really resemble one of their natural food sources.
And before we go, I want to ask you, Aaron, about something that one of our callers said earlier, talking about ropeless fishing. That sounds very high tech and possibly very expensive.
Very Star Wars. Yeah, that. So there is a group body, an advisory body, really, to the to the federal government, to NOAA Fisheries, called the Atlantic Largemouth Take Reduction Team. And it's a team of stakeholders that includes state and federal managers, industry representatives, whale researchers and biologists, and nonprofit organizations, conservation organizations, that all get together and try to brainstorm and advise NOAA Fisheries on the kinds of regulations for fishing, this one specifically for fishing, that would reduce the rate or severity of entanglements in specifically right whales, but also with benefit for humpbacks and fin whales. So two of the things that we're addressing right now through some working groups that the state is participating on, and also Patrice through the MLA, Maine Lobstermen's Association, is ropeless fishing is one, and weaker vertical lines is another. So those are two gear modifications that we're exploring the feasibility of, whether it's going to be able to be scaled up into a fishery such as in Maine or other places, the cost of it, bringing in like safety, all of those things to bear. If it's feasible, you know, where and when can we move forward with regulations to protect the whales? And if it's not feasible, what are some of the other things on the table that we can bring to bear to try to add some protection measures? And we try to work with the industry as much as possible in that.
Well, thank you both so much for being here. That voice you just heard, Aaron Summers, Director of the Division of Biological Monitoring from the Maine Department of Marine Resources. Also here, Dominique Walk, Assistant Stranding Coordinator for Marine Mammals of Maine. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow, the past, present, and future of radio. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.